Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Begin countdown.
It's time for the 5 at 5 with Grant and Danny. The top 5 stories of the day.
All right, let's get to it. 5 at 5, G&D. Welcome back. 106.7 The Fan, your number one story on this, the 12th of January. Alabama steamrolls Ohio State. They are national champions. 52-24 final. Blowout win last night behind quarterback Mac Jones, throwing for 464 yards and 5 touchdowns. The player of the game was the player of Alabama's season, the best player in the nation. This year, the Heisman Trophy winner, Devontae Smith, really only played a half. Got hurt early in the third quarter. Still had 12 catches for 215 yards and 3 touchdowns. Over 620 yards for Alabama. Finished the season a perfect 13-0. They just made the Buckeyes defense, which is pretty good, look like they were playing against an ill-equipped high school team.
48.5 points per game. That's what that offense averaged this year. Playing a pretty much full SEC schedule and then went roughshod through Ohio State in the championship game. That's as good an offensive team as I've ever seen. That was as good as I've ever seen. That is a complete lineup of guys that are playing on Sundays in various roles. And they were really without the full services of Jalen Waddle, a guy that coming into the season was more highly touted and thought of than the eventual Heisman Trophy winner, Devontae Smith. He could barely go at 3 catches of his own. But that was complete and utter domination of an opponent that is really, really good in Ohio State.
Maybe the craziest Alabama stat I saw today: they outscored 11 SEC teams and their 2 playoff opponents, so that's Notre Dame and Ohio State, by an average of 49-19 this year. They won those games by 30 points. That's the SEC and the 2 playoff games. If you're looking for records that got broken or tied in the game last night or by this team this year, Nick Saban's championships that he's won, Devontae Smith's performance last night, the catches in the game, the touchdowns in the season, the reception yardage in the season, Mac Jones' completion percentage for a career, passing yards in the championship game, passing touchdowns tying Joe Burrow in the game. And no one talked about Najee Harris last night. All that guy did was pick up his 30th touchdown of the year, most in SEC history, 57 for his career, tied for the most in SEC history. Their 10th or 11th best player this year had a historical season. I mean, it was that kind of year at Alabama.
Just start to finish, utter dominance. And we're used to this from them, right? We're the guy that sits on his duff for 2 years while another NFL player runs roughshod. You know, the guy that sits behind Derrick Henry, who sits behind Josh Jacobs, who sits behind this guy and that. So just nothing but pros. I don't know how they recruit, by the way, to say, just, you know, sit here on campus for a couple years till you get your chance. But they do it, and they have I mean, 6 of 7 national championship Final Fours they've been to. The 1 year it was LSU that knocked them out of it. Unbelievable. What a run.
Story number one, Alabama again at the top of the mountain.
And that is it. The final score, Bama
52, Ohio State 24. Alabama does it. 10 regular season SEC wins, an SEC championship, a Rose Bowl championship, and national championship number 18. 13-0, absolute perfection.
Learfield and the Crimson Tide Radio Network. Eli Gold on the call. All right, story number two in your 5 at 5. Before we move on from last night's game, I think we got to give Nick Saban a little credit. He is the first coach to ever win 7 national championships. He didn't want to talk about himself last night, though.
To me, this team accomplished more almost than any team. No disrespect to any other teams that we had or any championship teams, but this team won 11 SEC games. No other team has done that. They won the SEC and went undefeated in the SEC. And then they beat two great teams in the playoffs with no break in between. Now, this is our fifth game in a row, from LSU to Arkansas to Florida to Notre Dame to here. And played 13 games and went undefeated. With all the disruption that we had in this season, I think there's quite a bit to write about when it comes to a legacy of a team.
Living legend. I remember being a kid, Danny, and reading about guys like Paul Bear Bryant.
Yeah.
He's moved past all of them now with the 7 titles. The only coach, by the way, to win a national championship in 3 different decades. One of the greatest ever. We could discuss if he's the best coach ever or just college coach ever, but no one in college football's ever done it better.
Just ridiculous. I mean, how deep the field is, how good the SEC is. Again, if you won the national championship and you're not Alabama, you probably had to beat Alabama over the course of the year. I mean, his worst year since year one when he took over, right? He got there and they went 7-6. Haven't looked back. Their worst year was 10-3. That was the absolute epitome. The bottom fell out. What's going on? Heads rolled. They were 10-3 that time. Just an absolute juggernaut. And I'd like to ask Nick Saban to calm down a little bit.
His enthusiasm is overwhelming all of us.
They played a football game, all right? There was a game, and they played in it, all right?
Story number three. Wow. The Wizards, what a turbulent 24 hours for them. They got their third win to improve to 3-8 by hanging 128 on the Suns and finally playing some defense. And then they found out that they had a couple of players that had to go into the protocol for COVID concerns. Bradley Beal, after he poured in 34 points and flirted with a triple-double last night on going back and forth with Devin Booker.
You know, it's funny, guys. I didn't know we were playing Phoenix until last night. So I won't say I had it circled, but whenever D-Book's, you know, on a schedule and whenever I got to play him, I always know he's going to give me his best. It's always a crazy matchup whenever we play. We both compete. We both guard each other. And that's what I love about our matchup. We don't shy away from the competition. You know, he pushes me. I push him to be better. You know, we're going to be in this league a long time, continuing to do the same thing. You know, my hat went off to him tonight, but we got the best of it.
Beal on NBCSW. What he's doing as a scorer right now is pretty much unrivaled in basketball the last week or so.
Can't stop him. He has the complete offensive game for this era, right? And you know, in the 90s when we were watching 86, 85 type games where you could sort of grab him and hold and you know, hand check and do a lot more, you could slow him down, but he's sort of like a 2.0 version of some of the best two guards that have done it. I mean, he knocks down open jump shots. He creates off the dribble, is strong at the rim, runs guys off screens like Reggie Miller in his prime. He's an impossible cover at this point. He and Devin Booker, I think you heard that kind of in the cut, mirror each other in the way that they play, but Beal's that much more of a playmaker at this stage. He's really added to the repertoire as he's gone on in this league. But you touched on the big point last night, though, GP. This was their best defensive effort of the season. Now, a dubious honor because they're still 30th out of 30 in terms of giving up points. And some of it was cold shooting from Phoenix. Guys threw up bricks that don't normally do. But at least in principle, encouraging defensive effort and a way for them to climb out of this toilet that they've gotten themselves in to start the season.
Leaders in the NBA in scoring this year, Beal, number one, 34.9. Look at the cushion he's built himself. Steph Curry is second, 28.6 points per game, over 5 points fewer than Bradley Beal so far this year. Almost 6 points behind Beal at this point. Then C.J. McCollum, Zach LaVine, and Jason Tatum, Beal's old buddy from their high school days, rounding out the top five. Before we move on from the Wiz, we do have to talk for a second about this COVID concern because it was 4 straight games where they played a team and then immediately someone went into the protocol, and it seemed like this thing was following them. I mean, they were dodging it like you're dodging wrenches and diving and dipping and ducking. And you know, Patches O'Houlihan's throwing stuff at you. But it caught up to him. And today, this has been their season. You get the win, maybe some positive momentum. You're without Westbrook. You're without Bryant. Beal's been doing this all by himself. And he's losing a couple more players in his supporting cast, potentially.
Worry about it, right? It's just it's the type of thing that's inevitable this year, and it's their turn to kind of to wear this, right? It's I don't know what they can do better. I mean, I know the new restrictions and the like, but it just seems like it's sort of their turn in the queue, right? Because I think you touched on it. It is and sort of seems to have been following them.
Story number four. What is going to happen in the front office early this offseason for Washington? It is time to determine in what direction they're going at general manager. We asked Ron Rivera about this on our show yesterday. Here is what he told us about the next GM and what he's looking for.
No, because, again, like you just alluded, there's more to this position than meets the eye. There's a lot that is encompassing. When I reflect on what I went through in terms of that part of it, you know, it had a lot of good people working it. And that's the plus, you know, because there's so much operational stuff that's involved as well. So there's a lot to it. This is not just, you know, picking players and making decisions on contracts or hiring coaches or what have you. It is a big task.
And that's him clarifying the idea that this doesn't necessarily just have to be someone who's a scout, you know, who runs the scouting department, that's going to just be running the football part of this. It could be someone who helps him do some of the other legislative things that sometimes fall between the cracks. He hadn't made up his mind on that yet. He's got to talk to Dan Snyder. I'll tell you that I think Kyle Smith has earned this job. I don't know that he's going to get it. I wouldn't anticipate that he is. It seems to me like Rivera wants to surround himself with, you know, people that he's familiar with from the past. Maybe him and Kyle Smith do get along and are buddies and are tight. And maybe he could be that guy for him moving forward. But Rivera, with his coaches, with players like Thomas Davis and Kyle Allen he's brought in, a lot of people do this, but it seems like he's the kind of guy that wants people he likes and trusts around him. I know this about Kyle Smith. He had one offseason to run this show, and it netted you stories like McKissick, Logan Thomas, Cornelius Lucas, Wes Schweitzer among free agents, you know, Ronald Darby on the other side of the ball. And then speaking of the draft, Antonio Gibson at 66, Cam Curl in the seventh round. If that's not a strong audition, I don't know what is.
So I don't know what this job is. And I will tell you this quickly. J.P. Finley reporting here moments ago that the Washington football team has requested an interview with Titans VP of player personnel, Ryan Cowden, per a source. Before the Titans, Cowden was, guess where? In Carolina with Ron Rivera. So there you go. Again, I don't know what this job is. And I'm not trying to be difficult or a jerk about it. Is this a regular GM? It's probably not that. Is it a player personnel role? Is it a salary cap role? Is it a head scout type role? This is what happens when you have one of these unusual or semi-murky type situations, right? Where you have the head coach that's also the team president. He's the president, but he's also a client kind of a guy. When you've got Ron Rivera, who's got the final say. You don't want a GM overruling you, whereas in most organizations, that's exactly how the structure should and does go. So I don't know exactly what this job is going to entail. If it's Ron Rivera saying, hey, go find me this, a guy that looks like X, Y, and Z, and then that guy goes and does that, okay. But are they presenting to the GM? Are they presenting to Rivera? It's a murky thing, and it's going to take the exact right kind of person who wants to work for Rivera, it seems like, in a position that's usually superior to the coach.
Story number five, 5 at 5 on Grant and Danny. How about this name being linked to the Eagles? A day after Philadelphia surprised everybody by waiting a week to then fire Doug Peterson, we said they must have somebody they really like in mind. Reports today that they have reached out to Lincoln Riley, the head coach at Oklahoma, about their opening. This was Riley on a special he did via Fox with Joel Klatt.
This is a four vertical concept, and this is, I think, one of the geniuses of this offense. You had a lot of base pass concepts that you did not care one bit about what the defense was
doing. Sure.
They're playing two man up at the top, and they ended up bracketing the slot receiver down here to the bottom, and we end up throwing a back shoulder fade into a coverage that you sit there and say, like, this shouldn't work. But our guys had done this so much, we would literally have days of practice where we would only call this play. You know, our guys get frustrated. Defense knows what's coming, and you're expected to just execute it.
Lincoln Riley's 45-8 at Oklahoma, makes $6.5 million. He's 37 years old, native of Lubbock, Texas, and played at Texas Tech. He's got the entire program in his palm. You know, he's got everyone that likes Oklahoma feeding right out of his hand. Does he want to leave to dabble with the National Football League? I've been on record for years as saying it's going to happen. I don't think it happens now. I think this Eagles job is beneath him, to be completely honest with you. I think Oklahoma is a better gig than Philadelphia. They're a mess right now. They're a hot mess, as the kids like to say. That job's going to get someone fired in 2 years. I really believe that. So I don't see him being the guy, but they are swinging for the fences. Give him credit for that.
Unless there's so much money that changes hands, then, you know, one of these kind of Matt Rule or John Gruden type contracts, then
you give him 10 and 100, above that. Maybe he comes.
Yeah, I mean, because here's the thing. People sleep on this. When you establish yourself as the guy at a college football place, at a Mecca, at a place where you always win double-digit games and you guys are always in competition for national championships, A, you write your own ticket. B, everything goes through you. You're the most important man in the state. In the NFL, you get one bad quarterback here. Doesn't matter what you did before. You're out. That's not going to happen in Oklahoma because he's now above reproach. He's now thought of as one of the guys, right? So he'll make his $8-9 million a year after he flirts with somebody else, gets a raise, and everything's got to go through him. You control all of it. In the NFL, it's a different animal.
12-2, 12-2, 12-2, 9-2 in his four seasons with the Sooners. Those are your 5-5 on Grant and Danny. We'll take our first peek ahead to this weekend's four matchups. One of the great weekends on the NFL slate. We are on to the divisional round in the playoffs. You're listening to The Fan.
Guys, Danny Ruye here. Hindsight, she's 2020. And 2020, to be frank with you, was a terrible year. A lot we couldn't control, right? Pandemic, crummy economy, job losses, the whole nine. Well, what can we control? How about what we do for a living, your job? No, make that your career. Don't look back at 2020 with 2020 hindsight and see yourself still stuck in that dumb 2020 job. Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take that free career evaluation. No IT experience, no problem. It's not rocket science. It's My Computer Career. You, I'm telling you, you could start a new life as an IT pro in as little as 4 months, all from the comfort and safety of your own home. Live online classes, they meet just twice a week to get you what you'll need to start your new career. And it's more than just a school. They'll actually help you get into the industry with job placement. All their employers that they work with hire My Computer Career students. It's not rocket science. As I said, it's My Computer Career. So go to mycomputercareer.edu, take that free career evaluation today. And when you go, make sure you tell them Danny Ruye from The Fan sent you.
Take our first look at this weekend's NFL slate coming up in just a couple of minutes on Grant and Danny here on The Fan. But last night, Danny, I saw a lot of people tweeting about this and talking about this. I'm sure the numbers were great for it. The first episode of Jeopardy since the passing of Alex Trebek. Now, they aired Jeopardy over the last several weeks. It was all of the episodes in the can that he had already recorded. And so the final one with him, they did a big montage and did something really touching. 37 seasons, I guess. He was the host of Jeopardy. I've never been a Jeopardy guy. I don't know about you. Like, I watch it casually from time to time, and I'll yell answers at the TV. But there are people, and I honestly didn't even know this until the last couple of months with his passing at 80 and the fight he went through so publicly, that, like, it is such a part of them that they're emotional over this. And I get when someone dies that that's sad. But, I mean, as a Jeopardy family, so to speak, like, that's a thing that happens and exists. And I guess I totally get it because I watch a game every night at 7 o'clock all baseball season long. Like, sports are my outlet. They're my release. They're my therapeutic ability to kind of unwind during the night. So if that's part of the routine, you make yourself a dinner, you sit down, you watch Jeopardy, and he's the guy for 37 seasons that greeted you and kept you company, I totally understand it.
Yeah, I was sad when George Michael died. I never met George Michael. Never knew who I was and never would have cared. But someone who was in your home every night in some capacity, right?
I mean, did you know Jeopardy was this big?
Yeah. Let me rephrase. It doesn't surprise me. I didn't know some of the numbers. You know, I couldn't have told you the effect it had on everybody, but it stands to reason. When it's part of the furniture, right? The same way Price is Right is that way to so many people, and, you know, Wheel of Fortune is that way to so many people, and, you know, these longstanding things that, through trials and tribulations, through ups and downs, you can tune in at 7:30 on ABC7, and you're going to see Jeopardy. You know, like, no matter what else is going on that day, there's an episode of Jeopardy, and answer in the form of a question, and, you know, you got the Daily Double and the crowd applauds. You know it, right? It's a it's comfortable right there, and I understand that feeling.
There's one contestant on Jeopardy that I could ever name, and that's Ken Jennings, who had the record streak of how many games he won in a row and is the most popular contestant ever. And fittingly, he was the guy last night who played host for the first installment of this program without the great Alex Trebek. And he started the night. It came out to a nice applause and then honored Trebek.
Here is the guest host of Jeopardy, Ken Jennings.
Thank you, Johnny Gilbert. Thank you, everyone. Welcome to Jeopardy. You know, sharing this stage with Alex Trebek was one of the greatest honors of my life. Not many things in life are perfect, but Alex did this job pretty much perfectly for more than 36 years, and it was even better up close. We were dazzled by his intelligence, his charm, his grace, really. There's no other word for it. Like all Jeopardy fans, I miss Alex very much, and I thank him for everything he did for all of us. Let's be totally clear, no one will ever replace the great Alex Trebek, but we can honor him by playing the game he loved. Jim, Tanae, Julia, welcome to the show.
And with that, they kind of launched into the show.
Yeah, well
for
done.
The record, it seems like he got really good reviews and people seem to really enjoy the show last night, so best of luck to him. Hopefully that works. What do you think is the better play here? Initially, my thought was you got to go with a big celebrity. You know, in the way that I don't know if you'd consider him a big celebrity, but like Drew Carey took over for
he's a
The Price is Right, and I thought that that was kind of seamless and awesome. But I would not have thought to go with Ken Jennings. Just, I'm not a Jeopardy guy. I'm not a part of that clique in that group, but I'm sure a lot of people said, why not Ken? I think it actually is a great idea. Like, there was a credibility to Trebek where I always assumed he was the smartest guy on the planet. He didn't come up with the questions or whatever. He knew all the
answers.
Yeah,
he may have been an idiot for all we know, right. Honestly.
He had him in the card, and he was kind of smug at times in this hilarious way. But, like, I always just assumed if you have to play a trivia game and you can pick one person, it's him because he knows everything. Ken Jennings gives off that vibe probably better than anyone because he actually does probably know everything, and he knows more answers than anybody naturally. So I've come around on this. Rather than picking a fill-in-the-blank celebrity who could become the face of the show, Drew Carey style, maybe you just go with the awesome contestant from years ago and someone that means something to the Jeopardy group. Because whoever those people are, and they're listening right now, they know themselves, they DVR it or they watch it, it's part of their night every night. Like, they like Ken Jennings a lot. He means something to them. So why not appease them and satisfy that base rather than trying to draw your eyeballs or my eyeballs because you're going to have, like, Samuel L. Jackson hosted for a night. You know what I mean?
No, I know exactly what you mean. So, to me, it's something that would never have occurred to me to do this. And to your point, it's about, you know, what your audience maybe wants at times, or maybe, you know, trying to make them feel whole. And here's what it is. The person that reads the question doesn't have to know the answer to the question. It's right there for them. You need the person who sounds the best reading the cue card. And I'm not saying that to make light of what the job is, because think about this. When there's a timed clue or whatever it is, Alex Trebek probably never stuttered, never stumbled, never had a misspeak in 37 years. You could probably count them on one hand. That's not an easy skill. It's really, really hard to do that. I'm telling you, I got to do reads. You do reads. You got a minute to fit the damn thing in. It's got to be just right. He had to do that on a national scale with question after question after question. Is your throat sore? Read the question. Are you hungover from the night before? Read the question. Does your you not feel like it? Do you not get enough sleep? Read the question. You got to be perfect. That's what I would care about. I would say, who's the best at reading the questions in a clear way? Who's got that sort of game show host feel to him? That's exactly how I would fill the role. But this,
well, then you're
is,
just going to end up with a Seacrest or a Tom Bergeron. Or, you know, like a Jimmy Kimmel or
exactly
somebody like that. Pat Sajak could do both, you know, something like that.
And honestly, exactly. And that's what I said. You know, you're not going to be as good as Alex Trebek, but give me the next best thing. But this actually makes some sense. And I didn't watch it, and I wish I had, just kind of a retrospect. But, you know, a former, you know, Wheel of Fortune champion hosting Wheel of Fortune, a former, you know, Who Wants to Be the Millionaire champion, the guy that won that time where he just was like, are you sure? What's your final answer? And then he comes back to host it. I wouldn't want that. But this is different because you're right. People kind of got to know Ken Jennings for hours. He just kept winning and winning and winning.
One guy I would be interested in that I think satisfies both of these categories as far as being the really smart guy that I assume knows all the answers, a la Ken Jennings, but also being a celebrity who I think it would be cool to see, is Neil deGrasse Tyson. I don't know why. His name came up on a lot of those, like, odds to be the next host things. And I never thought about him until I saw that, but I thought, well, that would be really cool. Because, again, I'm a dummy. I don't know anything about anything when it comes to Jeopardy. But to me, part of the uniqueness of the show was just the assumption that the host was all-knowing. And so if you have one of the smartest people among us hosting that show, I just think there is some instant credibility to it. But I hope that those of you, and there are lots of you, I had no idea. The numbers for the shows have been awesome. And just the outpouring and the amount of conversation about Jeopardy, I just never knew it was that big of a collection, a group of people that were in. But it's a thing, man. There's a following like there is for the teams mm-hmm. that you and I care about.
That's right. That's right. It is. And listen, I keep going back to our example where you think about sportscasters. I mean, I was sad when Steve Buckhantz was no longer the play-by-play voice of the Wizards. Like, what? Like, that affected me? But, yeah, I mean, it's because you get to know – you almost feel like you get to know this person that's in your home every night talking hoops.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I love the Wizards. I love basketball. And I like Steve Buckhantz calling basketball games. I love that. And I was moved to emotion when, you know, when what happens in this business all the time happened. You know what I mean? It's just – it's something I can absolutely appreciate.
Well, you said it. I mean, you get to know that person. I think that even though it's not really the case, it's almost like you feel like you're friends with that person.
Yeah.
You spend so much time with them. I remember I was at Cal Ripken Jr.'s Hall of Fame induction. He actually got in the same day that Tony Gwynn did.
Pretty
and I'll never forget being at that induction in Cooperstown. And I had an amazing seat. Not a bit, by the way. This is one of the coolest experiences of my life. I was about 15 feet behind Billy Ripken at that induction. Huh. I mean, it was just insane, right? And the guy, if memory serves, I want to get the broadcaster right. I think it was Denny Matthews, who was the longtime radio voice of the Kansas City Royals. And he gave a speech, and I still think about it all the time. He was getting sent to the Hall of Fame to represent the broadcaster's wing. And he basically said, you know, you guys have taken me with you to your cookouts. You've welcomed me into your living rooms. You've brought me on your boat. And he was talking about, like, all the places that people listen to the game. And I just thought that was such a cool way to describe that. And it's exactly what you're talking about with Buckhantz or anybody else. Like, these people are a part of the fabric in your life. So, yeah, it stands to reason. I mean, how often do people come up or meet you, Danny, and they reference something that happened on the show? Like, dude, you really don't like that kind of food? Or really? Your kid cried when he had to sit down and do that lesson? Like,
yeah,
it's as if we're good buddies, and that's good. I mean, that's hopefully how the show works and why it works, and you want to meet people and have them feel like there's a connection. But that's what we have with those broadcasters, and I think that's what the Jeopardy people had with Trebek.
Mm-hmm. I think that's well said. All right, and he was so good at it. Again, I watched a dumb game show that was on, I want to say it was 10:30 in the morning, whenever I was homesick or otherwise, whenever I had a day off, called Classic Concentration that he did. It was the dumbest game. The point of the game was they would show these, like, weird, like, depictions that would just be a play on words. Like, it'd be an oil slick, and then, like, an airplane, and it'd be, like, orange you flying or some kind of, I mean, that was a terrible example, but you get my point. It's like just weird turns of phrases that made no sense at all. And people would just sit there and stare at these puzzles and not get them. And he was just so smooth and wonderful at letting them down gently when they had no idea what it was, and like adding the next clue, just kind of moving on. And he was the show. He was the show. He was Jeopardy to me, you know, more so than the literature questions that I could never answer, or, you know, anything about plays or most any category that wasn't sports.
All right, some news from the gridiron. This is via Nikki Javala of the Washington Post. She just broke this within the last few minutes. Remember Martin Mayhew, who played here in Washington?
Yes, he did.
He played for the then Redskins from 1989 to 1992. I played with the Bills and the Bucks as well. He was actually recently a general manager of the Detroit Lions until 2015. Since he's kind of bounced around a couple roles with the Giants and the 49ers. He's their VP of player personnel. So kind of like their equivalent of Kyle Smith right now. Washington has, according to Nikki Javala of the Post, requested to interview Martin Mayhew for their GM job. So that's two names that have come out today. One, a former colleague of Ron Rivera's in Carolina, and now Martin Mayhew, the former GM of the Lions. who have been linked to Washington that they'll talk to about this opening.
There you
so
go.
They're getting closer and closer to kind of narrowing down that list. The interviews I don't think have begun yet, but Ron Rivera joined our show yesterday. He was going into a meeting as soon as he was done with us. And I don't know who he was meeting with, but he referenced a few times that he's got to meet with Dan, he's got to talk to Dan. So maybe these are among the things that have been covered since he chatted with us in the last 24 hours. Grant and Danny on the Fan, let's take that first glance at this weekend's games that we promised you next. For whatever reason, over the last hour and a half, some of the candidates that'll be in the running for Washington's GM opening are trickling out, kind of all in succession. Reports from all over the place. Martin Mayhew, the former GM of the Lions, who is now in the 49ers front office, will interview with the team. Ryan Cowden, who is in Tennessee with the Titans and spent 16 years with the Carolina Panthers and spent a lot of time with Ron Rivera. And it was just reported by Albert Breer and Ian Rappaport, among others, that Marty Herney, who was the former GM of the Panthers recently, who was there when Ron Rivera came to Carolina and has been there with him the last couple of years before being dismissed by the Panthers at the end of this year, he's going to interview with the team as well. I mean, Herney always was the obvious big name, so to speak, because it seemed like he wasn't long for the Panthers' job, and now there's an opening in Washington and he's available. But I tend to think it might actually be one of the guys that worked under Herney. Like, Cowden makes a lot of sense to me. Someone who came up in Carolina as a scout. Maybe they're not a GM yet. Because I think Ron Rivera wants two things. One, somebody he's very familiar with. And that probably means they were with the Panthers at some point. And two, I don't get the sense necessarily, if I'm hiring someone, if I'm Ron Rivera, I want to bring someone in to check me a whole lot.
Yeah.
I want someone who's going to say, okay, Ron, you got it. Or that I can kind of coach, that I can kind of show the ropes to and say, here's what I'm looking for, go get me this. He's got a shot here as the coach-centered approach that we keep hearing about from Dan Snyder, you know, in the press conference when they hired him to do everything and anything that he wants. So if you're going to butt heads with someone and that experience is going to be as fun for you, you don't have to hire that guy. I'm not saying this is a great thing, by the way. This is a lot of times how you get a lot of, you know, similar thinking and the, kind of what do they call it, herd mentality or whatever, when everyone just agrees with each other. But that seems to be the way that they've done things on the coaching staff is, hey, did you coach for the Panthers before? All right, you're qualified.
Come on.
Pick him up.
Yeah, I think it's wrong. I think it's an incorrect way of doing it, and it's the tax you have to pay when you're Washington. If you want a big name, if you want someone that's got clout, you've got to give them more power than a good organization should give. Now, if you got Bill Belichick, you sort of throw the rule book out the window, and you can have a Nick Caserio or the guy that left New England and went to Kansas City, whose name I'm blanking on for years. It doesn't matter who it is. You got
Scott
one of the
Pioli.
Greatest. That's the one, Pioli. It doesn't matter who you have. You got Bill Belichick. He does everything, and he's the best at it. Okay, fine. But for everybody else, for the regular organizations and the regular mortals, you should have a general manager who supersedes the coach in authority when it comes to personnel decisions and the like. Doesn't mean you don't have the coach make input. Doesn't mean you don't have everybody at the table. But the final say stops with the general manager, who's got not only this week, this month, this year, but the next 2 years, 3 years in mind when he makes certain moves. Coaches don't do that. They think short term, which is oftentimes a dangerous way to go about it. But the next best thing is to have an adult in charge, and that's what Washington has at this point. So, again, I keep coming back to the same thing, Grant. What GM wants the gig? You know what I mean? It's like an offensive coordinator that's hot and up and coming going to a place where he's not going to call plays. That's kind of the closest analogy I can come to it. And I guess there's enough people interviewing, so they do want it, and they want to be associated with Ron Rivera, and I kind of get that. But if you don't have authority, I'm not sure who's excited to take on the role.
Yeah, but don't
tell
undervalue.
Me what I don't know there.
Don't undervalue, number one, how much Ron Rivera's liked around the league.
I think that's
so
the hugest part, right?
People generally think he's a good dude. They like him. And getting someone to work with him is not going to be that difficult, number one. Also, don't undervalue that there's 32 of these jobs. There are people, I'm sure, that want the perfect situation or don't want to go somewhere where they might not have the power that they'd like. You talk yourself into jobs like this. You overlook flaws and deficiencies because there just aren't enough of them. It's the same as like a quarterback being drafted or signing somewhere. Like, first example that comes to my mind is Cam Newton in New England. I'm sure there were all kinds of things going through his mind when he went there. This team's not going to win this year. This is an offense without weapons. They don't have wide receivers. Whatever it is. I need to start. I need to play. If I don't have that job, do I have another starting job? So there's plenty of guys, I think, that would come here, as evidenced by all the names that are being leaked today. Some of them have never been a GM before, so that might be who they end up hiring. I think that'll have more to do with Washington's decision to do that, because I think Rivera wants to be the guy and not necessarily butt heads with anybody. But the other side of that could be, I mean, Martin Mayhew's been a GM before. Now, he may never get another GM job again if he doesn't get this one. Who knows? I mean, when you're the GM of the Lions, it can be a long road back.
Sure.
But having said that, I think there's something to GM, head coach, quarterback. There's 32 on the entire planet.
Right.
You can't get that picky.
And so maybe it's you, if you think you got a chance at success, you can get that cascade effect and then maybe, you know, get your name back into the on the good side of the line, right? If there's a non-GM candidate, take Martin Mayhew, for example. That Detroit stink is hard to wash off, you know, the Matt Millen sort of corollary, right, where nobody thinks you're any good because you're in Detroit. You may have been great, by the way, but, you know, the winning didn't really happen, and everybody sort of thinks of you in a negative light. Maybe something good happens if you bet on Ron Rivera and you get kind of that cascade effect where who was in the room when good things were happening? Give me the sous chef, you know, and then maybe that ends up being you. I could see that.
Yeah, and if you think this team's ascending, which there's reason to believe that they are, you know, you're coming into a 7-win team. Let's say in 3 years they're 11-5 and they win the division the hard way, not the easy way, and they win a couple playoff games or something like that. I mean, now you're the architect. You are going to get that credit. That cologne is on you. So you're guessing a little bit in that regard, too. I'll just be fascinated to see, again, how Kyle Smith figures into this. If he's not the GM, is he still here? I mean, I guess he's under contract, presumably. So if that's the case, I don't know where he's going. But you've been the de facto general manager without that title this year. Now, you and I have, and a lot of people listening, have probably gotten promotions before and done the work and had the responsibilities, but with that didn't come either the money or the title or whatever was supposed to come with it, right? It's not that fun. So if you have the offseason that they had as a staff, scouting and otherwise, coaching staff, whatever, where you look and you go, look at all of the moves that we made and how most of them worked and our batting average was great. And then they have this opening and you thought you were auditioning for it and someone else comes in from another building, that's weird to me. That whole dynamic is now really weird. Do you just stay there and work for that person? Maybe.
Yeah.
But weren't we all under the illusion, and maybe it was incorrect, didn't we all think that Kyle Smith was on his way to becoming the general manager, like, this offseason?
Yeah,
and
again,
what happened that wouldn't make you think that he's closer to that? I think this was as good of an offseason as they had in the front office in years in terms of getting things right.
It's this murky, unclear crystal ball or looking glass into who makes what decision with Washington. Remember, like, a free agent gets signed and Doug Williams is like, I did that one. I'm the guy that did Adrian Peterson. And Bruce Allen's like, I'm the one that masterminded the Reuben Foster signing. Well, what? What is going on? There's always this murky thing. So to me, I go, Kyle Smith did awesome. What are we looking at here? What criteria do you want to judge someone on? The team got better. All the guys that he picked worked out. He was dead right on some long shot bets. Yeah, he did a great job. Does that mean they weren't Kyle Smith? Does that mean he just had some good recommendations? Does that mean he doesn't get along with people in meetings? I don't know. I don't know what it means. But if the point is, if you just look at the results and then look at, you know, who wrote what reports about whom, you'd go, stands to reason Kyle Smith did a pretty bang-up job this year.
Yeah.
Are we having another John Schneider situation, who just signed an extension, by the way, in Seattle till 2027, where we've got a great executive that walks out the door because he wasn't buddies with the head coach in a former city? I don't know. I hope not.
I just look at the situation as a story that it's not him. And maybe I'm off base. And people that want to react can. We can open up the AAA Always On Call listener lines at 800-636-1067. Maybe the read on the outside looking in wasn't right. But when they reshuffled their front office around Ron Rivera when he got here this offseason, they empowered Kyle Smith and appointed him a role where the scouts on both the professional and the amateur side report to him. Whatever your title is, and his is the director, vice president, player, personnel, whatever it is, that's the GM, basically. Like, him and Rivera were acting general managers. And as far as a non-coach goes, Smith was that guy. And then they had the offseason they had and had the season that they had, and what we heard was he has a chance to prove himself, and now you just don't hear anything about him. It's just kind of quiet, and it's not like Rivera brings him up or talks about him a whole lot. So we don't hear anything about him, and they're interviewing all these other guys for the GM job. Now, maybe they announce in a week that Kyle Smith's the GM and they went through a thorough process. I guess that would make sense. But to me, it's just a story that this is not Kyle Smith's to lose. Grant and Danny on the Fan with you until 6:30 tonight on G&D. Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan. Thanks for making the show part of your day. Means a lot. Nick Saban last night leading Alabama to the national championship win over Ohio State. And they didn't just beat them. They drubbed them on national television. And when you just destroy everyone and no one can even hang with you to the point where you average a 30-point win against teams in your conference and in the playoffs, and there's just no one else that is left for you to play and nobody has even given you a game, what are you supposed to do? I guess celebrate in the confetti like they did. But I'm thinking about Saban. His first year in the NFL, he coached the Dolphins to 9-7. His second year in the NFL, Miami was 6-10, and then he rolled out, and he went back to college. He's almost 70, so we're never going to know now because I don't think he's going to ever coach in the NFL again, and there's no reason to. I mean, he might have another, you know, 6, 7, 8 years if he wants in college, and eventually they'll have to make the decision, okay, at what point is his energy or his performance no longer what we need, and let's have a conversation with him, you know, as he gets older or whatever. But I heard someone debating today, and I saw this all over the internet too. Is he the greatest coach ever or the greatest college coach ever? And to me, he is the greatest college coach ever, but I still think what Bill Belichick did in New England is way more impressive.
100%.
Because in professional football, it's just so much more difficult to consistently win, to consistently stay on top of a division against professionals where the best college players from the country make up the other team. Like at Alabama, he gets credit for their recruiting. He gets credit for them having the best roster. I'm not taking credit away from him for that. But if a random coach from their staff had to coach that team to every game this season and through the whole year and Saban wasn't available to partake at all, they're not going 6-6. What are they, 10-2 maybe? I don't know, 9-3 at worst, something like that. They're still possibly making the playoffs, possibly winning the national championship, very probably finishing in the top 10 in the country. So, yes, he's the greatest college coach ever. He's won a championship in three different decades. He's done it at multiple programs. Everywhere he goes, they become the number one team in the land. That's not a coincidence. But can we settle down on him, like, surpassing Belichick and becoming the all-time greatest coach? That's recency to me, and it's a little bit silly. It's just easier to do it at that level.
Yeah, so here's the thing. If you build a machine, it then is self-sustaining, right? Whereas this is a very simple thing to me. It can't be apples to apples because the NFL and professional sports operate with a salary cap. There is no such thing in college football. In other words, you could put as many guys on the roster as you want. You've got allocation of dollars in terms of scholarships, but Alabama spends more money than Vanderbilt does. Alabama spends more money on their facilities and on their, the niceties for the players and everything else than does, you know, pick your SEC rival, right? It's easier at Ohio State than it is at Northwestern to build a championship football team. Sorry, that's true. Now, he deserves credit for, A, being a great recruiter. Again, the thing that I think is miraculous is he convinces some five-star kid, come sit for 2 years and then get your chance to go. And then you'll go pro, and you'll be a first rounder probably, right? He does what John Calipari does with first round draft picks on one and duns, but he does it for 3 year stints at a time. It's amazing. He's as good a recruiter as ever lived on this planet. He and his staff have a system down, and it's amazing. And he's got more talent than his opponent almost every time. Pretty much three games against Clemson, I would say, over the last several years, he's been.
But
more
how much
talented
credit do you give him for that?
A lot. He deserves
I mean,
a lot.
They're going there for Saban. They're also going there for Alabama and the brand. Like, if he retired tomorrow, are guys just walking and going to another school? Some, maybe. But I still think they would make a killing. They'd be one of the best recruiting teams every year with or without him.
Right. It's an institution now. He's built this machine, and now, as I said, the machine sort of self-sustains. That can't work in the NFL. In the NFL, I think it is a razor-thin margin. There's superstars. There's Aaron Donalds, right? That guy's better than anybody else. But for the most part, there are, you know, 64 defensive tackles that could play and start for damn near anybody and be fine. Coaching, I think, at that next level where everybody's the playing field is way more level of nothing but stars at Alabama and Auburn and Georgia and Florida and everybody else, the best of the best, get there. That talent pool is deep and it's razor thin, those margins. You really see who the best coaches are. The Bill Walshes, the Belichicks, the Gibbses, the Parcells, guys that get more out of guys instead of just saying, my talent's incredible, it's better than yours, and we're probably going to win more often than not.
I think that had he have stayed in the NFL and continued to coach, there's a really good chance he could have won a Super Bowl. You know, I don't want this to sound like I'm telling you that Nick Saban's not an amazing coach. I think he's one of the greatest coaches that's ever lived. I mean, there is something about the way that he leads human beings, the way that he runs a program, and I don't mean a college program as much as an outfit, an organization, you know, leads a collection of folks in the same direction that allows for that cultural success that he has established. I also think from a football standpoint, you know, Bill Belichick has basically said this guy can go toe-to-toe with anybody in terms of just X's and O's and sitting there and talking shop. I was watching the megacast last night with Hugh Freeze and some of the college coaches that were breaking the game down, and I think in that setting Nick Saban would shine because you'd see this is an intuitive talent, a cerebral guy the likes of which who's just maybe a savant. I mean, he might be sharper than everybody else. So I think he'd win in the league. I do. I think had he have been a head coach for 15 years, he might have a Super Bowl or two, who knows, and have playoff success. My point is just let's stop with the what he's done at Alabama is the same as what Belichick did with the Patriots thing. And I don't even know why it annoys me. It just does. It gets under my skin a little bit. Yeah. It's just an easier thing to pull off. So maybe, I don't know why, I'm not even a huge Belichick guy in terms of like defending him or personally liking him. I think his act is tired with the media. I think he's a lot to deal with in press conferences. I don't really know why he loves to look as goofy as he does and think that that's funny. But he still is the greatest coach who's ever lived. And I think that we need to just properly smell these roses while we got them with him. And we'll see what happens with the Patriots next year. I mean, I think this year was actually a pretty impressive coaching job by him. I know some people will knock him and say, really? Tom Brady's not there and you missed the playoffs. Shows you who the real star was. You mean the guy that, you know, had a quarterback that struggled to throw forward passes at times and had six of his defensive players opt out for COVID and almost went 500? That guy? Pretty impressive year, I thought, with the Patriots with a bunch of undrafted free agent types at wide receiver. And I blame him for some of their personnel, by the way.
Well, like that's what I was going to say. Separate. Let's separate it. The head coach is different than the personnel guy. They can't draft a wide receiver to save their damn lives. They can't figure that. They're the AFC East Ravens. They cannot get receiver right. They're always swinging and missing in that regard. And they've made some, you know, we're smarter than everybody type moves that have actually not worked out. But Belichick is so good as a coach, they're competitive. But also this, remember how many opt-outs they had, right, coming into this year, especially on the defensive side of the football, where they went from one of the best units in the sport last year to a pedestrian at best and at times bad defensive team over the course of the season. So you're right in that sense. But we don't give enough credit. I mean, you and me, but the world at large doesn't give enough credit to this run that the Patriots had from 2001 to 2019. Basically two decades worth of absolute, pure, unadulterated excellence in a league that simply doesn't have dynasties anymore. In the 80s, they did. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, dynasties were normal. Salary cap, free agency, contracts, it eliminated all of those things, except with the New England Patriots. Their worst season, they were 10-6. Their worst season was 10-6, and that happened one time. Every other year, 11 wins or more, starting in 2001. Starting in 2003, rather. Absolutely incredible. It's the greatest dynasty in the history of sports, as far as I'm concerned, because it was different personnel constantly. When you do what the Celtics did, it was Bill Russell and a couple guys that couldn't dribble with their left hand. That's awesome. This is the NFL now, the greatest athletes in the world with constant player movement, and they found a way with different personnel, different identities, seven or eight different times over. Defense and running the ball, throwing the ball for 50-some touchdowns with Brady, then defense again, then the team that mugs you. Whatever you did worst, they were going to make you do that. They took away the thing that you loved, and he is so great. So when we're talking about Nick Saban, nobody's saying that he's a bad football coach. I'm simply saying, comparing apples to apples,
right,
you can't do that.
Right, the only reason I even bring this up,
slight peg.
I mean, earlier we talked about how amazing he is and the fact that he's the first coach to ever win seven national titles. Like, that's the lead, that's the story. I'm now kind of having a nuanced conversation with you because I've seen in a couple of places today where the claim is being made now, like, put it in pen, best coach who's ever lived at any level. And it's like, well, can we slow down a little bit on that? Tom pointed out that he did miss a game this year, the Auburn game. They won 42-13. They managed to throw for 300 yards and five touchdowns without him on the sideline. Najee Harris, 11 carries, 96 yards and a touchdown. They picked off Bo Nix a couple times in that game. Now, that is not proof that Nick Saban is not necessary. Like, I'll give you an example. More recently was Kevin Stefanski wasn't on the sideline for the Browns, and they beat the Steelers, and they scored almost 50 points, and he's, you know, their play caller and their offensive coach. Like, he set up the entire week virtually. He set up a culture that allowed them to overcome that. He gets credit, I think, for turning them around, and I'm not saying because, you know, that's probably some segment that got done by Stephen A. Smith this week where Kevin Stefanski's holding the Browns back. Just watch. Look what they do without him. Like, I'm not doing that with Nick Saban. All I'm saying is if he was gone for a year, I think this thing, and you give him credit for setting it up, I think it would just kind of keep churning along, and they would just be chewing teams up and spitting them out. But he gets the credit for establishing it, for building
it,
just like he did at LSU. And he gets the credit, in my opinion, for being the best college coach ever. Just relax on the Bill Belichick comps and saying that college's version of the Patriots, which is what Alabama is as or more impressive. That's all I'm asking. I don't think that's that big of a claim. Let's go to Andrew in Woodbridge, who wants to hop in on this. You can chime in if you'd like at 800-636-1067 a day after Alabama won it all. What's up, Andrew? How are you?
Hey, Roll Tide. So I'm a big Alabama fan, but, you know, I think a lot of people really don't touch on the aspect that Nick Saban builds these guys not just as football players but as productive citizens in society. You know, he has these speakers come in. You know, he had Kobe Bryant come in. He's had other speakers come in. He has a interview room set up for these kids so when their football career is over, whether it's at Alabama or at the NFL, they're prepared for that next level in life. And that's why he's able to get all of these four-star recruits and these five-star recruits who aren't upset about sitting for 2 years. You know, so it's like he says, it's a process. And he's got that touch.
He sure does. I mean, everything he touches seems to turn to gold. Thanks for the call. I think that's our first Roll Tide that we've ever gotten, like we're Paul Feinbaum or something. Have we ever had a caller say Roll Tide at the beginning of a call to us?
Now, we've played Phyllis Romolga's calls, and she says it, but I don't think one of our callers has said it.
Have we ever gone to a caller about college football, and they started a call like we're on some serious XM college channel in the South, and they go, Roll Tide.
Bama's dynasty has begun. Roll Tide.
Phyllis, we know that. You don't think we know that?
Because they're better than what you've got.
Well, obviously. They're better than what Ohio State has, I would say, after last night. Wouldn't you, Danny?
Nick Saban is a better man than you are.
Well, look.
Well, that's...
Danny's a fine guy, Phyllis.
I do some charity. I mean, that's not...
Turd.
You've done nothing wrong. This is not your
fault. What'd you call me? What did she call me?
Cow turd.
Unbelievable. Name-calling, Phyllis? Name-calling?
Do we have to result to that, Phyllis?
Hey.
We can have a conversation, can't we, just as people here?
Turd.
Unbelievable.
Hey.
Unbelievable.
Hey.
Just inappropriate more than anything. Hey, I like how Tom is now narrowed down so that she can like cut us off. Hey, 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 and hey.
Bits on bits. I love it.
But, yeah, that's
how
a first.
How dare you?
So file that's that right, one away please. The day after the national title. Roll Tide. Someone called in and told us that they wanted to Roll Tide. I guess next we need to row the boat from like a PJ Fleck fan or something like that. The only thing I want to add real quick before we put a bow on Saban is a couple people are tweeting me saying, hey, I disagree with you on, you know, he win a Super Bowl or whatever. He was not that good in the NFL. He coached for 2 seasons. One of them was 9-7. I don't know what he'd be as an NFL head coach. I just think that his game's fairly portable. It's not like that's some crazy college gimmicky stuff that he does. I think that he would have success coaching at any level that he coaches at, including the NFL. If you think, though, that he was going to rip off 5 titles in 7 years, maybe relax on that a little bit. But yeah, and I'm sure he does turn these guys into pretty good people. I don't know enough about the program and what becomes of all these Alabama players. I'll take a caller's word that studies it better than me. I know this. They put guys in the NFL, and the guys that I deal with, that came from Alabama, whether it's in Washington or in other organizations over the years, they care about football. They do the right things generally. I mean, they are among the best players in their locker room, and they prioritize being a professional. Like, they come from a place where they already had to act like a pro, most of those guys. Not all of them, but the vast majority of them. You don't have to worry about them not caring, not investing themselves, not practicing hard. Like, that stuff got worked out years ago, and that's not the case in every college program.
Now, if you have it in front of you, you'll get this right, but you don't know the quarterbacks that played for Nick Herring. Nick Herring, I just gave it away. Great trivia question, jackass.
Nick
Saban. Oh, my God. I wish I could talk. All right. You don't know the quarterbacks that played for Nick Saban in his last year in Miami. To tell you, the idea that he can't coach in the NFL, this is who he had in 2006. Do you have any idea who they are?
Nick Herring was one of them. Joey Harrington.
Yeah, Joey Harrington. I literally was reading it and I gave it away. Great trivia question by me. Awesome segment. I'll pat myself on the back.
Who's Nick Herring, by the way? Tell me
Herring is.
What are the strengths and weaknesses of Nick Herring's game at quarterback?
Nick Herring was Chris Herring's brother, the guy that was a pretty good college basketball player. I have no idea who Nick Herring is.
I will say this. Danny stumped me quite a bit because I was trying to think about who is Nick Herring? Who
I
did
couldn't
he play
either.
For? Where did he come from? Nick Herring from?
I couldn't pull it.
Nick Herring
from my brain that I made up.
From Louisville. Joey Harrington. So that was his starter the whole year? There's no way he started 16 games.
11 games for Joey Harrington.
Who started the other five?
Dante Culpepper got four starts.
Ooh, I remember that with the Dolphins.
And Cleo Lemon got a start for the Miami Dolphins.
And practice squatter Nick Herring.
Yeah, and Nick Herring, of course, was the MVP of that
team. He sounds like a double-A shortstop for the Reds. The player to be named later in a deal when they acquire a left fielder or something.
A guy that they like who didn't really hit in the minors and struck out a lot, but they like his tools. But here's the thing. Miami wasn't any good. Now, can Nick Saban coach? He showed that he can coach with better talent. When he had worse talent, which is what they had, they were particularly good down there in Miami. And he had a much better deal that's worked out way better for him.
Who was his quarterback in the 9-7 year? Do you have that in front of you?
I do. In 2005,
I thought it was a Chad Pennington situation, but maybe he was with the Jets.
You'll never guess this. You just won't guess it. No. I had no idea this was the
Ray
case.
Lucas.
I'll tell you that right now. Nope.
Can I get
Nick Herring?
Brock Heward's a good guess.
Here's your hint for both of them. The two guys that started games.
Ooh.
Washington Redskins.
Went to Miami from here. Give me initials.
GF.
Gus Frerotte.
Gus Frerotte, dude.
Okay, who's the other one?
I'll give you a hint. I'm at a game. All right, years ago, when I actually went to Redskins games, and a drunk redneck Redskins fan behind me got fed up with quarterback play. And he just yelled at the top of his lungs. He was talking about this guy. It's the wrong name. This is what he did. He yelled, "Oh, this guy sucks. Put in Rosenberg."
Sage Rosenfels. So they went 9-7 with Sage Rosenfels and Gus Frerotte?
And Gus Frerotte.
Maybe Nick Saban is the greatest coach of all time.
He might be, dude. He might be. Ricky Williams, 12 games on that team.
He rolled out, though, as quick as that next year when everything kind of hit the fan.
Yeah, remember, I'm not leaving. Bounced. What are you talking about, left?
Yeah, so quick to go back to college. I think he would have had a lot of success in the league, but it doesn't matter, and we're not going to have to see it now at this point. Or I shouldn't say have to. We won't get to see it. How much longer do you think he coaches at Alabama? You think it's like 3 to 5, or like he's the guy at 76 who's still sitting in the booth upstairs, like as the head coach, in air quotes.
It's a great question. How old is he right now this minute? You said he's 70 on the nose?
He's about to be 70, yeah.
I feel like it's 4 years. And then he walks away. He's like, "I'm retiring, all right?" And then that's it. That's just the end of it.
First, your Nick Saban's not terrible. We'll start with that.
I'm working on it, actually. Thank you for noticing.
It's pretty good. Second, he was very emotional last night. Like, oddly emotional.
You can hear it.
Well, no. Like, he was visibly crying on the platform last night, they showed. I don't know that happens if you're not starting to get close to the end. I'll say a couple of seasons left. Wouldn't shock me, though, if he starts to think about his next moves. 69 years old, turned 70 this coming October. For Danny, I'm Grant. Thanks to Tom and Thom behind the scenes. Much appreciated. As always, fellas, and thanks to all of you for listening. We are back at it tomorrow at 2 p.m.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.